Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I'm David Canfield, and I'm here for today's interview episode with Richard Lawson. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Today's interviews are on two, I would say, extreme ends of the Hollywood experience spectrum. Mm-hmm. We're starting with my interview with Timothy Oliphant, the star of Justified City Primeval, which is the sequel series to Justified. Justified originally ran on FX about a decade ago. It was a modern-day Western set in Kentucky based on the Elmore Leonard stories about Raylan Givens, a U.S. Marshal portrayed in the series by Timothy Oliphant. It was brought back last year again by FX, streaming on Hulu in a sequel series called City Primeval. This one set in Detroit, adapted from another Leonard novel. And then we have your interview with Bridget Lundy Payne, one of the breakout stars of... I think the best movie of the year so far. I saw The TV Glow, which we will get into in a bit. But to start with my interview with Timothy, you know, there are interviews I've learned, and then there is an interview with Timothy Oliphant. This is not your average interview. I say that in the best way.
Anyone who's seen him do, when he used to go on Conan's talk shows or, you know, back in the day, he was a singular guest. So I'm calling you Conan O'Brien, basically, David.
I'm honored. Timothy Oliphant came to shoot the shit a little bit, I would say. We talk about coming back as Raylan Givens after a long break. The show was very well received. We talk about Little Gold Men. He gets a little meta. He has some advice for us on how to run this podcast. Richard, I hope you listened to that pretty closely. We also talked about a rumored feud that he'd had with his Justified co-star Walton Goggins back at the end of the original series run. He's very, very open about it. I do want to stress, because you can't see his smile if you're listening to this. This was said in good humor and with a lot of love for Walton, but also a lot of honesty about what it felt like to wrap that show, which was such an intensely emotional experience for the both of them.
I would come from the writer's room and have like things that were like, here's what we need Walt to do in order to get to this finale we wanted. And then Walt would... say his character would never do that, and then I'd be like, God damn it. And then we'd get really frustrated with each other.
And then beyond that, there's a lot of tangents, a lot of digressions, all of which I really appreciated, and I hope you will too. So let's go to my interview with Timothy Oliphant.
David, when you're ready, I'm ready.
All right. That's what I like to hear.
How are we doing?
We're good.
Where does this find you?
I am in Los Angeles, and where are you?
I'm in Los Angeles. Walk outside. I'll meet you. Where are you?
I'm in Hermosa Beach, so I think I'm a little far away from
you. Oh, that's not Los Angeles.
Listen, South Bay born, it's where we all end up at the end of the day.
Okay, good to know.
I hear you're taking a little break, though, from life in Thailand right now. Am I right about that?
That's true. I'm lucky and blessed to be working and working in Thailand, which is not bad.
So you're shooting the new Alien series. I'm sure you cannot talk much about it, but how's it going so far?
I'll tell you whatever you want to know. Go ahead.
How's it going so far? Working with Noah Hawley, et cetera.
That's nothing wrong with that. I don't know if you're familiar, but he's very good at what he does. Very good.
We talk about him on this podcast from time to time.
Oh, really? He makes the Little Gold Men cut.
He makes some things that may or may not be in the Little Gold Men conversation. Yes, as do you, by the way.
Well, that's nice to hear. I appreciate it. I really do appreciate the invitation.
I've been a fan of Justified for a long time. Since we're already talking about the awards nature of this show, perhaps we can just jump right into that part of it, because I feel like this is a show that was often underrated in that regard. You're, of course, back with a new edition. Raylan Givens comes back.
David, I'm not going to argue with you. If you say it was underrated, I'm just going to take your word for it.
Let's put it another way. The show had a great run initially. It was a critical hit. There were a lot of fans, obviously enough for it to come back so many years later. How did you observe its initial run? You say you're not going to argue with me, but did you feel like perhaps wasn't fully embraced in that part of the industry?
I thought we deserved a lot more awards and acclaim and popularity. I'm just joking.
If you weren't, I was nodding.
You were right there. You were right there with me, David.
I almost had him.
I love you. You know what? I don't care what they say about you. I say you're a good dude.
What are they saying about me?
Listen, that's another podcast. When I think about the whole deal, I had a ball making this. It was a great gig. I was living and working in LA. It was a steady gig. It was a ton of fun. Yeah, it's one of those gigs you can't believe you're getting paid for it. You know, I just had a ball making this show. And I felt very lucky to do it as long as we did.
And you said that you kind of always knew you'd bring Raylan back at some point. What about him felt like the kind of character, the kind of guy who could live in TV in that way, always having the sort of potential to return?
Well, Elmer's got a timeless quality to his work. And I felt it was a character that could age well, meaning he could come along for the ride with the times. I just thought there was a lot of room, you know, there's just a lot of room to play around with it, play around with the genre. Not unlike what they do, you know, and you see those Bond films and they keep doing them and they keep bringing them back. And, you know, they have the luxury of bringing along with them the baggage they want and reinventing the parts they aren't so proud of. And I thought we could potentially play a similar game.
Mm-hmm. You've also done it before with Deadwood. You've already brought a character back.
I had such a great time doing Deadwood, and I went into it so grudgingly, and it was such a rewarding experience that I also made this one a little easier to jump into.
Yeah, what about it felt different? They're both men of the law, very different styles, periods, etc. But given that you'd done it before, was it a little easier to slip into the shoes that you were familiar with again?
Well, yeah, and this one came... Like I said, when we pulled the plug on it, because I guess technically we kind of pulled the plug on it, I did think that, you know, if we had a little room, we could come back at it, and it could be a lot of fun to play around with. We all liked each other. We all had a ball doing it. And it didn't disappoint. It was very satisfying to do it again. Mm-hmm. Did I answer your question, or did I dance around it?
Maybe a little dancing, but not too much dancing.
You just tell me, David, down there in Hermosa Beach. You know what I mean? I don't know what they let you get away with in Hermosa, but...
You're finding out in real time.
What am I up for, by the way? Is that what we're calling it when I'm up for something? Like an award?
Yeah, we could say
it. Show about
it.
Awards. Is it a drama series or is it a limited?
I believe so. It's a drama series.
It's a drama series?
Yeah, because you've played him before, so...
Oh, is that the deal?
Yes.
I like that you know the rules. I like to know your rules. I just like to know, you know, I just like to know the landscape.
I like that you like to know. Not everyone likes to know.
And by the way, let me be clear. As they say, it's just an honor to be snubbed. You know what I'm saying? It's just an honor to be snubbed.
We should say you have been nominated for this role before. It is important to note that.
Oh, why is it important to note, by the way?
Well, you said it's an honor to be snubbed. You weren't snubbed every time, is what I'm... Just clarifying for the listeners.
By the way, and I'm not putting a negative or positive spin on it.
Okay.
Snubbed 5 out of 6 seasons.
Yes. Thank you.
How do we feel about that? You appreciate that info?
I appreciate that info. As I said at the beginning, I think that underserved the show and you. I feel like we're getting to the real feeling there.
I appreciate it. No, listen, I'm with you. By the way, I listened to the show Little Gold Men, but I don't think we talk about Little Gold Men enough. Are you guys taking notes? Do you take viewer feedback?
We do.
You take listener feedback, I should say.
We do.
Yeah, I feel like you should just lean into asking the guests, like, you know, what do you think your chances are? You know those things that come out every year, who should win. Thank you. Who should win? Who will win?
Uh-huh.
Just make your guests answer those questions.
Okay.
Yeah. Just throw out a name here. Hey, Laura Dern. Who do you think should win? Who do you think will win?
You know what I mean? Can't wait to hear her answer. Do you have an answer ready to go?
go ahead. Shoot. Go ahead. Ask me.
Drama actor.
Who should win?
Yeah.
Who's there's no nominations yet, right?
There's no nominations yet.
All right. Give me a list. Give me five names. Give me five strong.
You know
candidates.
Who is in the race this year?
Yep.
Walton Goggins from the series Fallout.
By the way, he should win and he will win.
He very well may.
Can you win for playing it feels like it's a knock if there's if it's a video game thing. So I'm going to say he should win.
Okay.
But I don't think he will win.
All right.
But I'll vote for him. Don't get me wrong.
All right.
Because I've seen it. He's wonderful.
He is.
But although, you know what? They made him look very unattractive. And I think I think voters love that when an attractive person looks unattractive. But he's not a victim. I feel like maybe a more victim that could help.
Yeah, you might be right.
And we got shot at when we were shooting Justified.
I heard about that.
Primeval. And when the bullets were flying and I thought, I think I might get killed, I thought, I wonder if that helps my Emmy chances.
That's the first thing that would come to mind.
And then I was like, well, do we have enough in the can? Maybe I just want to get wounded, because if I get wounded, I feel like that helps with the sympathy poke. Uh-huh. I feel like, fuck, but I didn't get shot. So I'm reminding people we almost got shot, because I feel like that could help.
Thank you. We do have some voters who listen, so that's an important data point for you.
God, I hope so. God, I hope so. Okay, so Walton's in. He should win.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. We don't need to break down the whole category. I honestly will admit I'm a bit sidetracked from where we were, so you'll forgive me.
That's the way we do it, David.
That's the way we do it.
That's the way we do it.
Keep me on my toes. It is a fun category, though. I will tell you that.
Oh, good.
The last season of The Crown in there. Dominic West playing Prince Charles.
Oh, let me tell you a fun fact. I worked with Dominic West on a little picture called Rockstar way back in the day. Yep. We all had a lot of hair. Lovely guy. All right. So he should... he should be in there. He's a wonderful actor. He's been a wonderful actor for a long, long time. And just a charming guy.
Do you generally pay attention to the race, as it were, the landscape? I'm not going to say race, to the landscape, to what's going on in TV.
No, I can't be honest. I don't watch a lot of, it sounds pretentious. Let me just say, I'm going to say something pretentious. I really don't watch a lot of television. It drives me crazy.
Or a film guy?
Well, I like...
only if it's directed by Steven Soderbergh.
I fucking love that guy. Oh, that guy. Does he listen to the podcast? Is because I love
I can
that guy.
I can neither confirm nor deny. We are big fans of Full Circle as well on this podcast, which you are also in, which is also eligible this season.
Eligible. How are we doing, though? Is there any?
You know, I don't want to make the Max folks mad at me, but it was a quieter debut, I think we can say. So we'll see. But it's a great show.
Okay. Well, listen, I'm not disappointed, because let me tell you something. I got to go to work with him, and so there's no downside to that gig. That's going to be one of those gigs that just keeps on giving. I just love that set. But I know where we were talking, though. We were talking about all these amazing people I get to work with.
That's
on this
right.
show.
You're right.
And how the amazing writers on this show give those people, they get to like really dance. Mm-hmm. And this movie was no exception. It was like, I got to do a scene with Paul Calderon. I got to work with Terry Kinney. I mean, everyone, Marin, Norbert, Victor Williams. I could have just done a whole show with Victor Williams. I just loved it. I just loved it. Vondi Curtis Hall. Where's he on this? Yeah. Should win, will win. Because that's a hell of a performance.
I don't have a list here. I'm just telling you. We don't do lists at Vanity Fair.
David, really?
I know. Not yet.
Well, I'm not going to hold that against you.
Like you said, there's no nominations yet, so we gotta.
I'm here either way. I'm here, and
you're on our list.
And I appreciate. Well, I appreciate it because I like going to the party every year. You know what I mean? I'd like to keep getting.
Me too.
I'd like to keep getting the invitation. Do you go to the Vanity Fair party?
I do. I cover the Oscars. I go to the Oscars and then go to the party.
You've never come up and said hello once.
Well, now I will. Now we've had this, riveting introduction to one another, so we'll be ready to go.
Riveting, is it? That's the word that comes to mind.
I'm having a good time.
Listen, let's, we got it. We're doing it. Might as well have a good time.
We're doing it.
Is there another agenda other than that?
No.
We're not convincing voters here, right?
We might be.
Really?
This is your platform to convince as you wish.
Let me tell the voters out there a little something.
Please.
I'm not going to get any better. So, you know what I mean?
You didn't tell Noah Hawley that, did you?
Oh, no, he knows that.
Okay.
But he's like, that's fine. I don't expect you to get any better.
Got it.
He knows this is where this is it. This is as good of, I don't see myself becoming a better actor from like 50s to 60s.
Uh-huh.
I don't think so. I think I'm just like right now I'm like in we're just steady.
Can I challenge that a little bit?
Oh, let's hear it. I'd love it. Hey, you're going to tell me I'm going to get better?
Well, you're an actor who started a bit.
Tell me.
You got to let me finish the sentence. You're an actor who started a little bit later than some. Right?
It's true. Thank God.
Talked about how you walked onto Deadwood. There's a lot of nerves attached to that kind of experience when you're a young new actor.
That's true.
I would describe the work that you've done the last few years as among the most exciting of your career. I mean that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that, and I don't take that lightly. I'm saying I don't think I'll get much better than this.
Okay. So we're
don't
already
get me
flattening.
Wrong. I've worked very. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. If we were talking like a sport, I would be telling you I've worked very, very hard to try to make the game as effortless looking as possible, and I'm proud of the work. I don't know if it'll ever get much better. I've also been very lucky with all these parts. They give me really amazing writing and makes the job much easier.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segeith, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
I've read you describe like various situations, being a part of various projects, and I found it very refreshing that you don't seem to have a jaded quality about it at all. Like being at a Full Circle premiere with Steven Soderbergh, I saw you talk about, like that meant a lot to you to be able to be in that room and watch it with them.
Oh my God. I mean, this is not my own doing. I've been very blessed. I have a wife and children and brothers and buddies from high school who just hit me below the knees, all the time and just keep me. I have a lot of people in my life who say, Tim, shut the fuck up. you know? And that I find very helpful.
Crucial quality.
I'm telling you, whether you're in this business or not, any business, those people are extremely important. Yeah. This afternoon, I was having lunch with my wife, and I caught myself saying, you'll appreciate this. I said, well, I can't remember what we were talking about doing. I said, well, I can't do that. She says, why? I said, I have an interview with, I got to do this interview. And she said, with who? And I said, it's a Vanity Fair thing. And she said, oh, yeah, I have an interview with Vanity Fair tomorrow. Yours is today. You know, she gives me shit. And then I catch myself, see? So I'm very lucky. This kind of work, I've been doing it long enough to know it doesn't come, they don't just hand these kind of shows out, and they don't hand out this material. Mm-hmm. Writers like Andron and Provenzano and Taylor Elmore and Issa Davis, who joined this year, those people are very, very good at what they do. And when you're working opposite Paul Calderon, and he's just got that, tossing the ball back and forth, it doesn't look like anybody's trying. It's so moving. Mm-hmm. It's so effortless. Just makes the job so easy. That's not every job that comes along doesn't provide that kind of that kind of material, that kind of atmosphere. Those are special moments, you know. I watched that guy work for a long time. He's really fucking good at what he does.
Yeah.
It's very special to be sitting there for an afternoon working with him, you know, and that same goes for, you know, working with Vondi, working with Ingenue. I got to work with my daughter on this show. It's very, it was very special, a very special experience. So, you know, it's all very, I count myself lucky.
Not too bad.
And, you know, sitting here, as much as I say, catch myself earlier saying I have to do an interview. The fact is I enjoy these conversations. It reminds me that my, you know, I have a very special job, and I appreciate your awareness of my work. I mean, it just means a lot. So thank you.
Awareness spreading all the way down to Hermosa Beach, California. Look at that.
I'm huge in Hermosa.
You're huge in Hermosa. Probably are. You know, it's a small population here. So given this kind of grounding force that you're talking about in your life, the shut the fuck up brigade, as I will call it, how do you find going to a very extensive Thailand shoot at this point in your career, really being away from home, away from your life? Is it something that you're used to? Is it hard to get that kind of sense of rootedness?
Well, I mean, don't tell Noah this, but if my kids were still living at home, I don't think I would have done the job. I mean, Justified, Deadwood, Santa Clarita Diet, those really allowed me for a good stretch. My children's, you know, their teenage, you know, somewhere between like sixth grade and then all the way through them leaving the house, I essentially got to work and live here in Los Angeles and be able to go to their tennis tournaments and take them to music classes and whatnot. Well, once they all left, and we hate them for it, but you know, it's a bit like, and I just asked my wife if, you know, you want to go to live in Bangkok for a few months. And if she says, yeah, I'm in. So it's a really fun time. Don't tell the kids, but they're not that missed. It's really been, it's really been great. So the last year, well, even going back to this job, I mean, I think we, you know, we did Daisy Jones and lived in New Orleans for a couple months. This one took us to Chicago. It's full circle. We lived in New York for a few months, and now we're living in Bangkok. And it's been a ball. You know, we haven't done this. I haven't done this since I started acting. You know, willingness to kind of pick up and go. And Bangkok's really special. I mean, the work's really lovely. The city's special. You know, there's a monster in that job. So, you know, the monster takes up a lot of screen time. So that lets me go down and go down the beach. I got to go see my buddy Walton Goggins down there filming. He's down there filming
Lotus. HBO series.
Yeah.
There were some theories that, oh my God, are you a secret cameo on the White Lotus? But of course, you're also shooting your own major television series
there. Yeah. They don't let me on that show with this hair.
don't know. It feels a little White Lotus to me. When the first time I saw it, I thought, oh, before I realized that's where Alien was shooting, I was like, they're doing that on the White Lotus this season.
Yeah. It was good to see him. So, yeah, he's doing good. So, yeah, it's been a ball, you know, and the job's been really cool. It's really special. Oh, yeah, you had questions about the – what do you want me to tell you?
Well, since we're talking about Walton, we're now coming on a year out of the show. It premiered last summer, and of course, it ends on a certain cliffhanger of Boyd Crowder's potential return. But I know you've talked about the desire to hopefully do more. How does the status of that look now that the show has aired?
Oh, I have no idea, but. If somebody told me that they wanted to do it, I'd give it the old college try to come up with something good. We've been having conversations over the years about bringing the show back. You know, I stay in touch with everybody, and you know, we'd get together and say, you know, we should do something. But it was hard to find the spark of what that thing was going to be. The book provided the spark, and I remember thinking, like, you know, if we can get the book. We could do a season, we could do a couple, because once we get everyone back together, the conversation starts. And we also don't have the pressure of coming back right away every season the way a TV show has. Mm-hmm. So I guess to answer your question, I hope it's still part of the conversation. I would love it. I know Walt would love to do it. The fact that they let the writers put that sort of cliffhanger at the end of this, I assume that means they're interested, but I don't know. We probably spent way too much money.
You know, it's a good thing, though, for viewers. It's a good thing. And yeah. I guess for you.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm not complaining. But, you know, if Walt comes along, he's going to cost him a lot of money, too. So who knows? Who knows?
So Walton recently gave an interview talking a little bit about the end of Justified. And he talked about the fact that you guys weren't really speaking at that point as much.
What did he say? Yeah, did he say why?
I can quote you. He said, we were deep into these people we were playing. They were so polar opposite that you were both a bit obsessed with the characters' points of view and carrying the weight of the conflict. Uh-huh. That's what he said. Can you share your perspective on that and clearly the eagerness that I'm detecting in working with him again?
See, Walt's a real actor. See, they should give him a trophy. You hear that? He sounded like an actor, didn't he? About us being deep into, you know what this guy was saying? It's like, well, there's just no fucking character. It's words on the page. Just come on, do what I'm asking you to do. That was me. Me was like, well, what are you talking about? What character? Come on. Yeah. What was the question, Dave?
Well, your perspective on that, you've given it, and then. How that, I suppose, relates to the eagerness that I'm detecting in working with him again.
Okay, here's my version. One is I adored working with Walt from the jump. But these actors, they're a pain in the ass. They get really into their work. So there definitely was a thing where as the show went, and especially as the season, as the thing came to an end, where I would come from the writer's room and have like things that were like, here's what we need Walt to do in order to get to this finale we wanted. And then Walt would say his character would never do that. And then I'd be like, God damn it. And then we'd get really frustrated with each other. And I also think looking back, you know, people have a hard time saying goodbye. Every time I'm on the end of any shoot, the longer the shoot, the more you feel it. Everybody starts acting funny. Everybody says summer camp comes to an end. Everybody starts acting a little funny. And I'd love to say that I'm immune to that, but I'm not. It's difficult to leave. It's difficult to say goodbye. And so, you know, some people make it easier to walk away, you know, whatever it is. But I've always adored that guy. And I love working with him, and he's something special. So it was fun to see him in this new job. I know he had a ball doing it. So it's I'd work with him again in a heartbeat.
All right.
Well, I'm assuming if we do it again, he'll be more predisposed to listen to me.
That's now on the Little Gold Men record. So,
yeah. Listen, we as soon as it wasn't my idea, that cliffhanger, but when the writers brought it up, I was a big fan of it from the jump, and I wouldn't have been if I didn't want to have another go. It'd be a ball to do something with him, especially if it was a justified thing. So. I hope it stays around in the conversation.
Okay, Richard, let's turn to your interview with Bridget Lundy Payne. I saw the TV Glow far more recently than you did and was completely knocked out by it. This is a movie mm-hmm. that's had pretty deafening buzz since its Sundance premiere. I wanted to start if you can outline what this movie is that everybody, at least in our circles, is talking about and what makes Bridget's performance within it so special.
Yeah, it's a film from Jane Schoenbrunn, who made a movie called We're All Going to the World's Fair a couple years ago. This film, I saw the TV Glow, has a bigger budget and the style to match that. But at root, it is as strange and searching as Schoenbrunn's first film. It's about two teenagers who become obsessed with a television show called The Pink Opaque that could be compared to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, maybe most closely, but also shows like Charmed. And then the movie traces that obsession as these two people get older. Bridget Lundy Payne plays both the teenage version and the adult version of their character. And it's a really fascinating film about trans identity, perhaps most primarily, but lots of other things, obsession and a certain late 90s culture that I certainly related to. And yeah, I was really curious to hear from Bridget, who is an actor, a writer, a director, a magazine publisher, it turns out, what they thought about this film's idea of kind of gender politics. And they actually had some pretty interesting things to say about that.
I mean, I've never been too interested in representation. I don't really think it matters to me personally, because I think often it matters, but I think often representation is a front for just sort of exploitation and normalization of marginalized identities that feel threatening to what we hold sacred as our capitalist kingdom, right? And so I'm really only interested in making sure that my transness is always kind of offensive.
And Richard, I hear that the circumstances in which Bridget conducted this interview were unique, let's say.
They were. So I saw the TV Glow is an A24 film. So Bridget was doing the interview with us from the A24 offices. It just so happened that day was Bring Your Kid to the Office Day. And so you might hear the noise of little children in the background. Very lucky children to be hanging out at the A24 offices. Apparently there was a screening of Marcel the Shell with shoes on. They brought puppies in to play with the kids. There was some sort of dance party, I believe.
Perfect.
So it's basically what you'd imagine from, if your parent works at A24 and you get to go to the office for the day.
I was just thinking, what A24 movie should they show? And you have answered it perfectly. Okay, well, with that in mind, let's go to your interview with Bridget Lundy Payne.
Well, Bridget Lundy Payne, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast to talk about this really remarkable movie that I saw at Sundance and was just so wowed by. It's such a dense piece of work. What were your first reactions when you read the script?
I really remember reading the script in a sort of daze. I think what stayed with me were the colors and the sounds and the feelings that it gave me. I could picture it as just neon creature coming towards me. And I knew that the story that I had just read was going to be something that I'd have to take a lot of time and meditation to understand, because obviously it's an allegorical script. And so I knew that it would be something that I'd understand through my body over time.
Yeah, I mean, the allegory of it is fascinating. I think it could be read a lot of different ways. Jane Schoenbrunn, the writer-director, brings something to it. The actors bring something to it. A viewer brings something to it. How does it read to you? What do you feel like it's saying to you? What is the story about?
I think it's a story about how urgent it is to understand how to tell the truth for yourself. It's a story about transition and specifically what it feels like to recognize that you're trans and that you're going to need to destroy your life to realize yourself, the self that is aligned with your actual desires, and that's a deeply painful process. But I think it's also about how we know what the truth is, but we often are unable to listen to each other as we're saying it. I think that we spend a lot of our time lying to each other. And transness is one way to discover the truth, but I think that everyone has to do the work over the course of their life so that they can live.
All of what you just said exactly resonated with me too. And you know, obviously this is a story that seems pretty personal to its filmmaker. I'm curious what kind of conversations you and Jane and Justice had on set. What was there sort of an evolving understanding of the script or the story being told as you filmed?
Yeah, a lot of the conversations that Jane and I had were leading up to shooting. And so, because I had the script for a year before we started. And so Jane and I would have weekly Zoom calls where they would tell me, first they told me about Maddie and where Maddie came from for them and what their relationship was to Maddie. And then they told me the lore of TV Glow, which is something that you kind of have to watch again and again to understand. There are certain frames that you can pause on to read more and to understand where the film takes place in the lineage of the Pink Opaque. But I think for me, most of the story came from a real internal understanding of what it meant to be trans and to need to move despite the terror of becoming.
The Pink Opaque is the show that the two lead characters are obsessed with and finding lots of hidden meaning in. I'm curious, did you have any sort of cultural object like that as you were coming up, like as a teenager or adolescent, something that really just spoke to you more than a piece of entertainment?
I kind of realized today, because I've been getting asked this question a lot, and I'm like, I don't know, not really, because I didn't watch a ton of TV when I was growing up. But my one major obsession was Ariana Grande, and I watched her YouTube show that she had with Aaron Simon Gross called Freaky Forever, and I didn't realize till just this morning how trans it was, because it's Ariana and Aaron switch bodies. And I was really obsessed with it. Like, it really consumed me. But I didn't watch Buffy or, like, fantasy shows until I was preparing for this. And I watched I watched up to season 6 of Buffy before we started shooting. And it was so delightful. I wish I'd watched it earlier.
Watching Buffy, did you see what might have spoken to a teenage Jane Schoenbrunn so powerfully?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I totally get it because I know what it's like as Maddie to be obsessed with the Pink Opaque, too. Like, I mean, when I see Helena and Lindsay, I freak out. Yeah, I mean, the world of Buffy, like, first of all, they win every episode. It's a triumph. And there's also just such a warmth in the community of their friendship and, like, in Giles's library. So, yeah, I totally get it.
So I would say maybe roughly half of this story is when you and Justice Smith's character are teenagers. I'm curious how you got into that sort of mindset, you know, de-aging yourself, so to speak, because the way that you two interact in the kind of high school set scenes is so intensely familiar, I think, for a lot of kids who felt on the outside of their school and their class. Did you feel like you, as an actor, you had to kind of really recalibrate yourself to play that age?
I think a lot of it was in the dialogue and a lot of it was set musically. Jane showed me a lot of the music that they had been really into when they were the ages of the characters. Cat Power was young Maddie's favorite music, and I would listen to that a lot when I was playing her. And then 1998 Maddie was like Hole and Team Dresh and like lesbian punk. And then, yeah, Final Maddie was more like creature. But I think, like, a lot of playing youth is just physicality. Like, the youngest Maddie has a totally, like, loose puppy relationship with her body. Like, she kind of, like, it, like, drags after her. And obviously the wigs helped a lot. And then I think I'm just, like, still pretty tuned into what it means to be, like, teen angsty, because I play teenagers a lot, but also just because I still feel a lot of angst. And yeah, I think, like, it's just playing age is just, like, it's just, like, clowning at the end of the day. You know, it's just voice and body.
Did you and Justice do any sort of, like, extracurricular kind of bonding stuff to kind of get this relationship to well, I mean, it evolves throughout the piece, but I'm just curious, because you guys are so in sync with each other. What was that working process like?
Yeah, we only met once before we started shooting. We had a rehearsal with Jane in an office space in Verona, New Jersey, and we had one rehearsal, but I think we immediately became connected, bonded, because we're both Leos. Our birthdays are one day apart. We're life path twins, wow, which is math that I can't do, but ask Justice. And yeah, we just had a lot of fun together. But I think also, like, the two of their relationships, it's not like they're, doesn't seem like they're like, I love you, man, type friends. Like, a lot of their relationship is the tension between them of, like, wanting to know each other, or, like, knowing that they both at their core are from the same universe. And so I think, like, Justice and I just innately found that. And then so much of the, like, for instance, the bleachers scene, so much of that was in Jane's directing and the pacing, because they really kept asking us to slow down, almost as if we were in two different conversations, like we didn't expect the other to reply, which I think actually helped synchronize the scene because we were really listening to each other.
Yeah, yeah. When the film premiered at Sundance, I think it was pretty much immediately one of the big hits of the festival, let's say, critically, certainly. Did you pay much attention to the reaction, and did anything about it sort of surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me at all. I knew that this movie was going to be really impactful from the moment that I read it. And also, I know Jane, and I know Jane is a genius. And so I knew that, like, it just would take a minute for everybody to catch up with that. And I'm curious for audiences to see it, because I think, like, it's one thing for people who really love movies or trans people or people who have a direct relationship to this movie. But I'm curious what it will feel like for everyone to watch it. I'm curious if some people will find just the television show angle of it a place to relate. I mean, I'm sure some people will really love it visually. And then some people will be like, this movie doesn't make any sense to me because they're trying to read it literally. And so, yeah, I'm excited to see what people think.
A lot of people were sort of heralding it as this hugely important piece of trans fiction, which I believe it is, but I think that it's that, but also more, you know. And I'm sort of curious where you as a performer think we're headed in terms of that kind of representation on screen. It's obviously been something that has moved more to the forefront of film, especially like independent film, but obviously there's a lot of progress that needs to be made. How do you sort of view that landscape, or is that something you don't really concern yourself with?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been too interested in representation. I don't really think it matters to me personally, because I think often, like, well, I mean, it matters, but I think often, like, representation is a front for sort of exploitation and normalization of marginalized identities that feel threatening to what we hold sacred as, like, our capitalist kingdom, right? And so, like, I'm really only interested in making sure that my transness is, like, always kind of offensive. And if not, then that's great. But, like, what do they think that I am that's making them so comfortable? Like, I don't think, like, I think the transness is, like, inherently anti-capitalist and something that should feel scary. And I think, like, that's what so much of Jane's work is about, like, the effect of, like, heteropatriarchal normalization on the physical body, that it's literally making us sick. And so, yeah, I'm not like ever looking at what's going on in Hollywood because I just don't really mind, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that's really striking about the film is that it is not a comforting piece of work. It's not saying everything will be okay and we can all get along. And, you know, I think there is an alienation that's so inherent to the piece. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that's like why Jane feels like so heroic to so many people, because they are telling us like it's okay for us to be deeply hurt and in a constant state of unsettlement, and for us to know that this isn't what our life force is naturally leading us into. Like, we are greater than these forms, than these oppressive structures. And so much of the work that's been made about trans people, usually by cis people, are happy-go-lucky stories about assimilating back into cis culture. And that's just, like, cute and might make some people feel good, but a lot of us don't feel good.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, I know that you also work as a musician, and so you have these kind of multiple hats that you wear. I'm curious, what's interesting you creatively right now? I mean, you have this film that you're promoting, but what is kind of holding your interest at the moment?
Yeah, I work on a magazine called Waif. I'm the creative director, and I've been working on that for about 6 years. We're about to release our 30th issue, and we're working on the website. We went on tour with the magazine and built the issue across the U.S. with different waifs around the world, around the country. So that's always fun because it just is like community and like, you know, playing with so many really, really smart minds. And then I'm working on editing a film that I made 2 summers ago called October Crow. And we're scoring it right now. I'm working with Minna from Daisy the Great and Absha from Lower Town. They're two of my close friends. And it's really, really fun. And they let me sing on one of the songs and I do a British rap.
So. Wow, that's exciting. Can you tell us a little of what the film is about?
Yeah, October Crow, it stars my good friend Alex McVicker and my upstairs neighbor Peter Nolan Smith, who's an old poet. He's been in New York for a long time. And he's a real philosopher of nothingness. And my mom, Laura, she plays a character called La Bruja. And it's about Alex coming to New York. And she's found by Peter's character, James Steele. And she's sort of like indoctrinated into this BDSM cult that's overseen by my mom.
So this was your first time making a film behind the camera, is that right?
Yeah. And we shot it with like 2 lav mics and my phone, and it was improvised. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Did you shoot this after you had made I Saw the TV Glow? I'm curious if Jane, either directly or not, imparted any kind of tips or whatever to you.
No, I shot it right before.
Oh, okay.
I shot it like the month before we started. It's funny because I actually filmed some scenes after TV Glow, after I'd seen it, and they're definitely influenced by it. Like, I am I'm not a filmmaker, you would say, but I'm definitely, whenever I can get my hands on a new tool, I want to play with it and try to make something as close to real. And so I really love this interview with Renoir, the French director. Mm-hmm. He talks about, like, we've made way too big of a deal of plagiarism. Like, the ideal, like, Hollywood would be every director is given a genre or, like, the same script and everybody makes it. And then that's how we see originality.
That's really fun. Yeah, I studied a playwright in college named Charles Mee, who he would write, I think, at the top of his plays, "You can take whatever you want from this for your own thing." And it's kind of a fun, radical philosophy. Yeah, so you're filmmaking, you're publishing a magazine, you're acting. Is there anything in any sort of realm that you would like to try that you haven't yet?
Well, for the next movie that I want to make, I want to write a script. Mm-hmm. And so that's something never done. And it's a movie about a street performer. And so I need to learn to tap dance for it.
Oh.
And I was taking tap dancing lessons with this tap dancer named J-Bo, and he taps in the subway and he gives lessons. And I got a little too confident and I went to TIFF, and there was a movie that was screening there that I had been in, Gabriel Labrante's Amelia's Children. And I really wanted the movie to do well. And so in order to, like, break any curses on it, I tap danced in front of the theater, but I tap danced on cement.
Oh.
And you're not supposed to do that. And so I really hurt my neck.
Oh, no.
And so I've been afraid to get back on the horse, but I'm going to get back on there. I'm going to bring my board and I will learn to tap.
It's a great skill to have in a performer's back pocket. You know, you could always head to Broadway if need be.
If need be, you know, as a last resort, we'll keep
exactly.
Broadway on the burner.
Doing anything goes on Broadway. Well, Bridget, you know, congrats again on the film. It's really, really, I think, one of the movies of the year, and your performance is so striking. And I really appreciate you taking the time and for your thoughts on the film.
Well, thank you so much.
That does it for this week's show. You can email us anytime at littlegoldman@vf.com, or you can find us on the internet. I'm at @DavidCanfield97, and Richard?
Rylaws.
We'll be back on Thursday to discuss the premiere of Hacks and how that is crashing the Emmys comedy race in an interesting way. Until then, our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.